Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This is the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today, Mikel Arteta's Arsenal score some brilliant goals to beat Watford. You decide on which was the best. We'll also be discussing the Manchester derby and Manchester United's poor performance. Are there too many scapegoats at the club? Elsewhere, big wins for Crystal Palace, Brentford and Newcastle. And we'll be asking Tony his opinions on the end of the season. Yes, Mr. Cascarino has joined the game. Hello, welcome back to the Game Podcast. I'm Hugh Wissencroft with you today, myself, Alison Rudd, Tom Clark, and joining us every fortnight from now on a Monday, the former Millwall, Celtic and Chelsea frontman, regular in the Times, of course, Tony Cascarino. Welcome. How are you?
I'm good, Hugh. Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here with Alison and obviously Tom.
Just Alison,
and yourself.
Yeah.
All three of you.
So. Good. We're delighted to have you. Look, plenty for us to discuss. Cracking weekend, particularly in the Premier League. We rarely do this on the Game Podcast, but we start this week at Vicarage Road, celebrating all that is good, all that is beautiful about the game, because Arsenal sit in pole position for a place in the top four. They're 6 points ahead of Spurs, who've played the same number of games. They're a point and 2 points ahead of Manchester United and West Ham, respectively, but they have 3 games in hand on both of those teams. So they're looking very good for what could be a stunning end to the season. But their 3-2 win over Watford was highlighted by exceptional team goals. And Alison, you were there to witness them. Before we get to the goal specifically, we've got to say, fantastic from Arsenal once again, because they're building a real style and identity under Mikel Arteta.
Yep, 4 games on a trot that they've won. And I remember talking about how they just didn't have that in them not so very long ago. Yes, he's given a young team, they're the youngest team in the Premier League, and he's giving them the freedom to express themselves and have a bit of fun and have faith in their ability. When they're in the groove, they're as pretty as any team in the top four. They lack gravitas. Defensively, there are problems there. And after such a joyous match in the early spring sunshine, it was just a lovely place to be. It was quite a shock to the system to see Arteta glowering afterwards. He was actually quite cross. And someone made a joke about the fact he going to claim an assist because he picked up the ball and gave it to Saka and said, take it quickly. And the throw-in led to one of the goals. And so, you know, after you've won a game and the goals have been so amazing and you were part of it, he should have sat there beaming and having a joke about it. If he didn't want to, he wanted to focus on the negatives from his point of view, which is they allowed Watford to look quite attractive too. And if Watford had held their brains together with their final passing, that they could easily have got a draw actually. So he and in a sense, the reason I'm mentioning that is I think that is a good sign if you're an Arsenal fan, that their manager felt there were flaws there. He wants to iron out. He wants more concentration. He wants them to be a bit more grown up and control games better. It was basically the lack of control in a game that they were sublime. Some of the passing was phenomenal. So they should have sort of steamrolled it, and they didn't. The fact that he saw a lot to get cross about bodes well, I think, for their challenge for a top four place. And I can't quite believe those words are coming out of my mouth, because they have been flaky and sometimes they do look immature. And there's a sort of sense of the way they celebrated their two recent wins over Wolves, for example. You sort of felt, you know, they just won a cup. They're too excitable. This should be part and parcel of their march towards Champions League football. I grown up enough to get there, but the fact that he was cross after a game in which there were moments, quite a lot of moments of perfection, I think is a good sign for them.
How do you read Arteta then, given what Alisson said, Tony?
I wouldn't disagree with anything Alisson said there. I'd also add in that, you know, the club have to take great credit in sticking by a man whose job was on the line. That in the early part of the season, we're all expecting there's one more defeat away from being sacked. With that, he's been non-negotiable on lots of things at the football club. He's let big players go out the door. He's got a mentality of, I believe, which is really important at football clubs, of players who really want to play for Arsenal. That is really vital to why that can be successful for them, because Martinelli, Saka, Odegaard, even Lacazette, because I think Lacazette's doing a very unselfish role in that team. Now, I see lots of good things. I was a big advocate of Arteta getting the job a number of years ago. I felt he had a side to him, and I'd heard a lot through his training methods when he was working with Pep and how his feelings of how he wanted his team to play, and it was very City-like against Watford. Look, don't get me wrong, I'm not comparing them to City, but it was City-like in the way they were clinical. Pace in their team, which breaks teams completely. They can, you know, I thought the performance of Saka on the right was tremendous, as in the fullback Kamara just didn't know what to do with him. He didn't know whether he was going to go inside, round him. And he's got an incredible habit of getting goals as well. And this is a young lad that's going to be having every club in the world wanting him very soon. So Arsenal have to be successful in some manner to keep the likes of him and others.
Let me tell you, Tony, the Arsenal fans that I know, they hate me at the moment, right? Because I've put a few things to them.
Not all the time, though.
Probably all the time, right? But we've had a lot of conversations about Bukayo Saka's contract. Actually, I wanted to highlight him mainly because he spoke after the game about how much the players are enjoying themselves at Arsenal. And I wanted to ask you how much that makes a difference to players when they are enjoying themselves. But his contract will have a year left in the summer, and he's going to have a decision to make. The club's going to have a decision to make. And all my mates think he wants to lead the rebirth of Arsenal and get them back challenging. And I say, well, if he signs a 5-year deal, what are Arsenal going to win in those 5 years? Where will this rebirth be in the next 5 years? Because he could just spend those 5 years getting Arsenal back to the point where they challenge for the title and not a massive amount otherwise. So for me, I think it's a huge decision, because I agree with you. He could go and play for one of the current best teams in the country, if not in Europe.
He's talking about the Harry Kane syndrome, which is now known as, isn't it?
Yeah. Let's get this right. Okay, when you're a young man and he's still got a lot of time on his side, if the club are so desperate. I've been in this position myself with Teddy Sheringham at Millwall, where we got promoted. We've done really well. We both got contracts put in front of us that were comparable to the best in the league at the time. I was told the deal that I signed, this is just me personally, when I was at Millwall, was as much as what the champions of England at that time, which were Arsenal, was getting. So I signed a contract which the players that won the league, they paid me that sort of money to keep me at the club, okay? Now, Arsenal are going to have to do a similar thing, because if they think he's worth 120 million, for example, then you're going to have to pay him as an 120 million pound player, because you can't demand the fee and not pay the wages.
Yeah.
So there is an obstacle there. I think for him, personally, if he really believes Arteta's improving him and that's going to continue, then I would see every reason to stay. And look, football changes really quickly, Hugh. You can be. I signed that deal that I talked about with me. I was gone a year and a half later. You know, so that 5-year deal is, yes, it's safety for the club in some respects. But generally, if you fail, there is, you know, the Harry Kane scenario is a bit of a one-off, which it does happen. But I believe that he would sign a new deal because Arsenal will have to put a contract in front of him that him and his agent are going to be excited by to keep him at the club.
Well, will it depend on Champions League qualification?
Oh, absolutely, Al. If you fail, then you're at every danger of being the vultures hanging around your football club to take... You know, I look at Saka and I think he's so suited to Liverpool and Man City. He's so suited. Now, if they don't... I mean, I look at Saka and think, well, if they lost... Liverpool lost Salah, he would be the one I'd go after because there's way more goals in there. He's probably slightly even quicker than Mo Salah. I don't think he would score as many, but there's room for improvement. So the vultures will be hanging over your football club if you don't achieve some of the goals. So it would be very hard to keep him at Arsenal if they fail.
The thing, the argument that I put forward to my mates was I would wait. If I was his agent, if I was him, I would wait for the first half of next season to see how the club continues to grow. I wouldn't commit too early. There's no reason to commit early, really. You're talking about 6 months' worth of wages, which you can probably get in the contract negotiation anyway if you do sign it after that period of time. But Mikel Arteta's still a young manager, still hasn't really proven himself. It's still a very young and inexperienced group of players, and it could still go the other direction at the start of next year. Plus, you're looking at the likes of Man United. You don't know who they're going to appoint. You don't know what will happen at Spurs. The competition might be stronger for the top four next season, and they might well be back in the Europa League. So it's not to say don't sign a contract at Arsenal. You know, I'm sure he's very happy and that's the place he wants to be. But I definitely wouldn't commit too early. There's no reason to. The club's going to want you. How much money are they going to have to pay to replace you? They're going to want to give you that new contract. And the other thing is, I felt really bad saying this because I said to my mates, look, if you look at around the league and some of the young players who got big deals, over £200,000 a week for Marcus Rashford at Manchester United, who I think is on about £220,000 a week. Anthony Martial was on about £250,000 a week. He got given that contract as a young player at Manchester United. You look at the players at City, they're going to be toward the 200,000 mark. And you start thinking, they gave £300,000 a week plus to Aubameyang. They gave that to Mesut Ozil. So where do you sit? Do you sit 250 a week and above? That's what I'd be asking for. I'm just saying, I would.
You take the mentality of the lad in consideration. If you think he's a great pro and a great young... sort of leader without being the captain type, I think you can get really lost with going examples. You can give us examples of anything in any form, especially in sport, of saying, well, look at Mesut Ozil, look at Alexis Sanchez. But you can also turn and say, well, look at performances of someone like Mo Salah when he signed a new deal. He didn't drop off. And he became Virgil van Dijk as the, you know, the highest paid player at Liverpool.
I'm saying these were vitally important players for the club at the point that they sign their contract. So I'm saying, if I'm Saka, how important do you think I am for the future of this team? If you really regard me as one of the top two or three
what
players,
what you're saying is, do you think he's saying...
you want him on the cheap?
If I'm his agent, I'm saying, how much do you value Bukayo Saka? If you think he's one of your most important players and he's led you to the Champions League and he's going to do it again and again and again, I want a lot of money. Because
do you value me so much that you're going to give me so much money that I can then play for the next 6 months? Well, that's what you're saying.
Well, that's the business, isn't it? That's the game.
No.
Listen, he's been brilliant. He's been absolutely brilliant. And I'm sure he wants to stay at Arsenal. Great to see him with a big smile on his face at the end of that game. As I said, talking about how much the players are enjoying themselves at the moment. I just want to ask you, when you're in a changing room, everyone's having fun. What difference does that make to a player's life?
You don't want to be anywhere else. That's what a difference it makes. You're loving your team. You're enjoying you playing your football. And you're an exciting team that's developing and going forward. So, you know, it isn't a coincidence. There's very few players that leave clubs. And if you want to go to your own club, Manchester United, many year, no one really wanted to leave Man United. It was going backwards if you did. Now, if you're at that type of club and that mentality, which I think has been instilled by the manager, Arteta, at Arsenal, there is a progression there. Now, obviously, that has to continue. But being part of a happy squad, liking each other, it doesn't mean you have to be nice to each other. You're going to have your fallouts. But generally, you're all pushing for the right goals. And that is to try and be successful. I did a piece earlier on in the season talking about when Arsenal were pretty dreadful at the time, saying that I really believe they could still make the top four. Now, I'm not trying to be smart here or pat my own back. I've got some other things dreadfully wrong, like saying Leeds will make the top six, which they didn't. Okay. So, but I felt that they could, because I do see that Arteta has done an amazing thing with just creating the right environment to have every chance of being successful, which is important. It's no different from what Man City have done. Man City have spent really big, but they've created the environment that it's based upon. This is going to be the pathway to our success, and it's non-negotiable.
Well, team goals are becoming a bit of a hallmark for Mikel Arteta's Arsenal side. Tom, three brilliant goals from them against Watford, Ødegaard, Saka and Martinelli. Which was your favourite?
Oh, good question. You put me on the spot there, Hugh. Thanks very much. Probably the final one, I think, Martinelli's. I think the pace and the one-touch moves was just superb to watch. But I think when you talk about those great goals and just jumping on some of the things the guys have talked about there, it's about identity, isn't it? And the quality of the players they have are not of a level of Manchester City and Liverpool. But I do see Arteta, he's got an identity to this team. And so that's why I've been kind of pushing them the same way Tony has this season, because I think it would be great if they did finish fourth, because that is what Tottenham, Manchester United are lacking. They don't have an identity on and off the pitch, and that's what Arteta has given Arsenal. And also, I think quite telling in these games, I don't know whether, Alisson, you noticed it, but as well as the beautiful goals, there are also a couple of moments of kind of good bit of grit and determination. There was a lovely moment, not lovely moment, but the moment at the end of the game when Watford were really wound up and Arsenal kind of did a few kind of clever tactical fall to the floor, win a free kick. Kieran Tierney did a few wind-ups. There's this great video going around on social media where I think it's Hernandez who's all fired up and Tierney just goes, come on then, let's have a scrap. What, you want to take me on? Let's have a go. And, you know, I think Thomas Partey as well in midfield is becoming more of an important player in terms of like sitting and kind of disrupting things in midfield and giving the ball to those beautiful attacking players. So it all comes together, I think. It's starting to, certainly for Arsenal. I remember us discussing that draw with Burnley and go, oh, they need a goal scorer. They've cocked it up. And then they go on another run. So to answer your first question, the Martinelli goal for me, the most beautiful. But I think there are lots of other moments there that are just making an identity for Arsenal. And that's why I hope they get the top four.
Point of order, and I genuinely worry if that I've lost my sense of humour or missed the joke, but on match of the day two, they decided there were only four goals that you could call sublime. Well, I wrote in the Times that all five were marvellous. What was wrong? Moussa Sissoko, nice feet for a big man, beautiful control, made Ben White look a little bit, you know, stupid. In what way? Was that not worthy of highlighting?
Ben White's defending is the reason that Moussa Sissoko probably wasn't given.
You can only beat what's put in front of you. I thought it was a very strange decision. When there's a great game, lots of, I mean, and
you have
loving
the ability.
The BBC are just so into the goals. I mean, that's how they edit everything and how they, you know, they organise their running order is on goals, goals, goals. And they have a game with five amazing goals and they decide to be sniffy about one of them. Ridiculous.
So that was your favourite in the game?
On that basis, yes.
Yes, go on, Alisson. I think as well, it's just very briefly, we should just touch on Watford. And I thought they were fantastic for periods as well. And obviously for a neutral, they really added to it as a spectacle in that their brilliant goal, the overhead kick goal, came from a kind of counter-attack back and forth. I think Ramsdale kicked the ball long. Arsenal went on the counter-attack, nearly had a chance. And then Foster did the same thing. Low kind of kick out to the halfway line, counter-attack, overlap, overhead kick. They were superb. And as Alisson said, could have got a point. So Roy's given them something to fight for.
And isn't that lovely about English football? That this was a match where there was a team, deep, deep relegation bother, and a team that really does need to secure that Champions League spot. It didn't feel like that. There was no desperation. It was joyous.
My favourite goal was Ødegaard's, the opener. Just the little back heel 1-2 with Saka. Finished it. It was like a knife through hot butter, basically.
Shame he won't be at the World Cup, isn't it?
Yeah. But I think he's getting better and more influential as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Could have spent the time talking about Martin Ødegaard, and I'm sure he will before the end of the season. As you mentioned, though, Tom, Watford banging trouble, 8 straight home defeats, 3 points from safety. They've played 3 games more than Everton, who are just above the relegation zone. They've played the same number of games as Leeds, who I guess it's most realistic to catch up with them then, 4 points behind them as well. So it could be a difficult end to the season for Roy Hodgson and his team. We'll come back to the top of the table, the top four, towards the end of the podcast as well. But let's stay with further down the table. And not really the relegation places as such, but rather the sides that are pulling away from it. Big wins this weekend for Crystal Palace, Brentford and Newcastle. Let's start with Palace. They're now 10th into the top half, 7 points taken in the last three games. They went to Wolves, won 2-0. And more when you watch Palace, there's a sense of excitement with their play, especially with Wilf Zaha back in the team. Michael Olise doing well on the other side as well. Very good win for them, Tony.
Yeah, and I tell you what, they did brilliantly well. They got behind Wolves an awful lot. You know, considering how good Wolves have been defensively this season and hard to break down, Palace did it with quite ease at the weekend. And when Wilf's at his very best, you know, you think he should be playing in the Champions League. And I've always felt that about Wilf. When he's on his game and he wants to be quite direct, he'll cause any fullback problems. And he always gets a goal tally. You know, you look at his numbers, it always feels like every season he's been... He's never been... I would never go as far as saying he's a one-man team, but I think Palace are such a much better team when he's on his game. I think Jeffrey Slup has come in and done really well. I think he's added to that. I mean, look, and they've made a couple of signings as well with Boy Guiu from Chelsea. He's done brilliantly alongside Anderson. So there's a lot of good things going on for Patrick Vieira. And incidentally, he's had about four or five changes in his forward line. He's not played. So Christian Benteke can't get near the team. It feels Edouard has not played as well. So there's a lot of forwards there that he's got an array of, you know, let's say Eze's been injured for a long period. So I think Palace fans are, I mean, look, most of us all have complaints about what we haven't got, but I think they've got far more in the forward areas than they've had for a long time, Palace.
And nice passing from Anderson at the back. He's really come on under them, actually.
I watched him in Lyon a lot. And you're right, Al, and he played well at Fulham and... You know, although they went down, he's come in and he settled. That partnership with Guiu is really been good for Palace.
They're in the FA Cup quarterfinals as well, as I mentioned, in the top half now, Tom. How excited should the Palace fans be about the Vieira era, or what should really be called the Vieira?
I think you mean I might need to work on that one, Hugh.
It's not my worst.
I think... Palace fans, and I sit next to a couple in the Times office, I think Palace fans will not be getting too excited yet, principally because they're Palace fans, and they'll be a bit cautious and a bit worried about things getting too carried away and some of those young players that you've talked about maybe moving on. But I think us neutrals, you know, I was thinking about the conversation that you, I and Alison had about underrated teams, you know, and we listed Southampton and Wolves. I think Palace are not far off being included in that category in a few weeks' time when we do the same segment again. So I think that's something to be excited about. On the subject of the defenders, Roy Hodgson made an interesting point, I think, in a press conference recently that, you know, it in slight defence of his time at Palace and the kind of pragmatic way in which they played, those defenders, Guy and Anderson, in terms of launching those attacks with kind of a bit more... accurate and creative, a bit more modern defending forward passing. You know, no offence to Gary Cahill, but it's not kind of the same level of passing ability that you're going to get in terms of playing those balls into the channel around a fullback or splitting a defence. So I think they're a big part of what Palace are doing under Vieira as well, that across the team, they're just slightly elevated in terms of technical ability, probably.
Yeah, I think it's been important. They're a different team.
Yeah.
It was one of those managerial appointments, I think, that a lot of people were saying that's a risk.
Yeah.
You know, hasn't pulled up trees necessarily in his other jobs, but I think...
Can I just say on that? There was a lot of, I felt, misinformation about Patrick Vieira's time at Nice. Mm. He actually done okay. They got seventh in the first year he was there, and they had troubles. They had some money issues in that time that Patrick was there. He done okay. It wasn't like he'd done a disastrous job at Nice. He'd done, like I said, more than okay.
High expectations there, though,
yeah,
isn't
of it? Course. It's a big challenge coming to the Premier League. But I think what he's shown is an enormous amount of versatility in how his team play and personnel that he'll change quite readily. You know, and signings they brought in. You know, you think we haven't even mentioned the boy Gallagher, have we, Conor Gallagher? You know, he hasn't been mentioned, and yet he was pretty superb for him at the weekend as well.
As he seems to always be, and we've spoken about whether he'll get a chance at Chelsea. Maybe Palace is going to be his long-term home. We've spoken about Thomas Frank in the past. A big win for Brentford, beating Norwich 3-1. Ivan Toney getting a hat-trick in the game, ending an 8-match winless run for Brentford. They're now 6 points clear of the drop. How much of a plus I've got to say it to you, Alison. It's Christian Eriksen who started his first game since that cardiac arrest.
It's all unfolding exactly as I predicted it would unfold, which is their slide would be halted when Eriksen was fit enough to start. And so it has happened. And the players have said so. I think what happened was it was rumoured that Eriksen would be joining Brentford, which would make him the most glamorous, biggest signing ever in their history. That in normal circumstances, they wouldn't be able to attract or afford a player of Eriksen's quality. So once it was in the ether that this might happen, I suspect there was a sense of anticipation and waiting for it to happen. And that might have impacted on how they performed subconsciously, that they knew they were waiting for some sort of push. And so now that it's happened and he is part of the group, he's been training with them. He knows them all anyway because half the team are Danish. They all get on incredibly well. And they now feel like they're whole, they're complete. And the players have said, you know, he brings not just his passing ability, it's his vision, it's his reading of the game, the way he talks to them. The whole sense of you just watch him on the pitch. It looks like Christian Eriksen's played for Brentford for several years. Mm. He's integrated so well, and just adds that touch of quality that makes the team feel good. We've just talked about that with Arsenal. It's a bit like having an Odegaard at Brentford, and so it's just lifted them completely, knowing that he can play. There's no more worries about whether he'll be fit enough or it'll work out. He looks perfectly capable of playing in a tough, rough-and-tumble Premier League game. And they can now go on and use that little bit of extra sparkle that they probably didn't think they would get. If you think about it, they had a fantastic start to the season, Brentford, and then, you know, inevitably it's going to dip off. You know, they have the lowest wage bill in the division. They're brand new to the division. They're a small outfit. That energy and passion you get from it being your first campaign, you know, people are going to work them out and so on. And they, without Eriksen, it could have happened that they would slowly fade and go into the relegation spots. But the Eriksen factor is enormous. It's enormous on every level, psychologically, emotionally, practically, and in terms of the, you know, creation of goals on the pitch. It's just going to be fine for Brentford.
It's not bad, that, was it?
No, not at all. No.
Great explanation on Eriksen there with Al. What I would say is I was lucky enough to watch him play against Republic of Ireland at the Aviva Stadium when Denmark won 5-1.
Yeah, yeah.
And I come away and said, what an unbelievable footballer he is. And by the way, dead ball situations, so effective, causes an enormous amount of problems. Now, if you go, and what Alison touched on about what he gives technically to the team, which is a lot, and then you add in set pieces and you say, well, they've got Pinnock, they've got Johansson, Aya and Tony, four very good headers of a ball. So it was no coincidence at the weekend against Norwich that a couple of corners he got rewarded with goals from. OK, and that's what he'll give, for even forgetting about open play, because he's still got a lot in them areas as well. You're going to see probably one of the most inspirational transfers, I would say, in the Premier League, because he had an injury. If we just look at it as an injury, although it was a heart issue, if he is recovered, which we all know we're having a defibrillator, that he's going to be fine to play, this guy will cause teams a lot of problems. He is way beyond the Brentford level. He was at Inter Milan, you know, which is one of the great European teams in the world. And he's played an incredible role at Spurs. So him playing at Brentford is, although it's, for him in some ways, it's a come down because Brentford are a team that have been coming through the divisions. I think it's a boost that no other that we've seen in football in the Premier League, because he gives so much just technically and set pieces to a side, I would say will probably be, and we'll see by the end of the season when he's in the team, we'll probably have the best numbers on goals or penalties from set pieces because he will be taking them.
Right, our producer's now up to John. We're going to get him to get these stats by the end of the season. We'll come back to that one and see if you're right, Tony. Tom, Newcastle United, 5 wins in 6 games for them. They survived pretty much a second-half onslaught against Brighton to win 2-1. Ryan Fraser is the player that stood out to me in this game. Desire, work rate, he got himself a goal. He looks very fit. Again, it's been a long while since we've said that about him. His Bournemouth days, really. It's just a complete change at Newcastle. you know, during this period of time, they're now basically a mid-table side. We're not even thinking about the possibility of them going down.
Well, again, speaking on behalf of Newcastle fans, as I did with Palace fans, I'd say, calm down, Hugh. Let's not get carried away just yet. It's not over yet. But, I mean, it's interesting. You pick out Ryan Fraser there. Early on in Eddie Howe's kind of revival, it was all about Joe Linton and what he'd done with him and his positioning. A few weeks ago, we were talking about Jonjo Shelvey. I think that is the thing that Eddie Howe deserves credit for as much as anything, because we all said, oh, he's going to get loads of money, he's going to buy all these players and, you know, they'll trot up the league. To me, it's actually more impressive and more interesting what he's done with the players that were there already. And so, as you say, when you have Ryan Fraser performing as he did, and I think Murphy as well looked pretty good and kind of attacking using his pace, that to me is the thing that Eddie Howe's done most impressively. Yes, signings like Dan Byrne continue to be very, very important target as well. It's those players that he seems to have either elevated in terms of their positioning and getting more out of them, or just kind of reignited their kind of enthusiasm and passion and fitness. That's the thing he deserves most credit for.
I watched this game, and as the goal updates were coming through and every single other match was goals flying in, I thought, why am I sticking with this game? You know, Newcastle at that point, 2-0 up, I was like, they're going to win. But actually, the second half, the fact that the way that Newcastle managed to repel Brighton for virtually all of that game, yes, they conceded a goal from a set piece, but they got battered. I mean, they could barely touch the ball for most of the second half. And at any other point in this season watching Newcastle before this run, they would have lost, even at two goals up.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just like the confidence. They almost felt comfortable without the ball. And we'd criticised their defending so much. And we said Eddie Howe is not the man to solve their defensive issues. The fact that the Brighton couldn't score a goal from open play despite having basically all of the ball in the second half, I think was a massive credit to Newcastle and a big change, as you mentioned, from Eddie Howe.
Hugh, he changed three out of the back four. And most importantly of all, Dan Byrne. Because I did a piece for The Times and we talked about important signings, and I put Dan Byrne as the top one for Newcastle at the time because I felt they needed a ball-playing centre-back. Which we talked about with Palace just now, about having the importance of having someone who can be given and be trusted with a ball. I think he's made a huge difference. You talked about Ryan Fraser. Ryan Fraser was the player that didn't want to play for Bournemouth because the move to Newcastle was adamant that he wanted to go, that Eddie had to not play him. I remember him referencing and saying, I can't play him. You know, his mind's elsewhere. And yet he's been so shrewd in his management, he's got Ryan Fraser playing the best football of his career now. So you have to give a lot of, you know, towards Eddie, how he's managed that job, because there was so much wrong at Newcastle. They needed, when he got the job, European form to stay in the Premier League and even Champions League by the start of the sort of the new year form. And they've just got a normal second to Liverpool in points since the turn of the year. That's been an incredible turnaround.
Yeah. Four straight defeats for Brighton, Alisson. 13th now in the table. Graham Potter's obviously a terrible manager.
Now, what Brighton are very good at, and you sort of referenced it when you talked about the second half in that game, Brighton are very good at battering you and getting nothing back. It's what happens at clubs that don't have reliable strikers, or they have patchy strikers, streaky strikers, I suppose. I mean, I really love Neil Mopay, but he ebbs in and out of form too much.
What would you take, Al, at the start of the season? If you said Neil Mopay and you said, right, how many goals? Where would you go? What number would you put would be significant in the season?
Well, he's only been significant because he scored some eye-catching late goals. And, you know, got them points where they were getting none, got them a point or 3 points where they weren't. And that's been dramatic. And maybe takes away attention from the fact that he's not doing it for the previous 90 minutes. I don't know.
Because I think there's lots of clubs in the bottom half, say mid-table and below, if they can get someone who gets 10 goals around or just more, like Ollie Watkins got, 13 for Villa in the Premier League last year, I think. You know, that sort of number, that should be enough to keep you in the league and maybe a bit more. But it's very, you know, no club in the mid-table and below are going to get a striker that gets them 20-plus goals, aren't they?
Yeah, but they have... But their possession stats aren't the possession stats of a team in trouble. They are a team that are doing everything else pretty well. And it's that final step, isn't it? It happens. It's not just recently. It's happened regularly under Potter that they've had periods where they've still played great football, but they're losing.
Yeah, they had 68% possession at St James's Park. Neil Mopay came off the bench on the hour mark as well. Interesting that he's got 8 Premier League goals and doesn't start games like that as well. And that, I think, says something. Tom?
But it's interesting, we're coming down to the kind of mid-table in the Premier League. And, you know, Tony, you've talked about some of those players scoring 13 and whatever, but Hugh, you mentioned Arsenal with Lacazette doing unselfish play, i.e. linking and setting up other people. You then look at the other teams, we'll come to them to talk about. You know, Liverpool sometimes play without a recognised striker. City have done it for basically 2 seasons. United did it yesterday. The idea of a striker who then scores goals, it's interesting how we all these other teams, Brighton's, etc., are maybe looking to emulate and copy this kind of free-form type football. But then actually we then go, but they need a striker to score the goals because these forward players aren't clinical enough. I mean, what does that do, Tone, you know, when you take away a position, if you like, in order to put in a more of a recognised striker? Because I think some of these teams, these mid-table teams, if you put a recognised striker in, maybe wouldn't have the same kind of counter-attacking ability, say.
Well, you're not going to get the same returning goals. That's pretty clear. I mean, Mopay is a finisher. I mean, I've watched him a lot, and I always feel that I did, I talked about this about 2 months ago, about keeping him on the pitch, even if you're losing 1-0 or you're winning, or it's 0-0 in a game or 1-1, just keep him on. And he got a number of late goals. Because I think there's one thing you can destroy a forward with their belief, more than just, say, confidence, but their belief, it's a similar thing, is that if you keep thinking you're a forward and you haven't scored at 60 minutes and you're looking at the sidelines, you're thinking, my number's up, I'm coming off, which Graham Potter did a lot of times with Neil Mopay in the early part of the season. It's like, why do you keep doing that? You need a goal. He's your best finisher, quite clearly. He's going to get your biggest number. And yes, you can have possession, but the possession is only useful if you've got someone that can finish off a move. And I think he's been guilty, Graham Potter, of sometimes being negligent in that area of not keeping a striker on. Look for other areas of the pitch you may change around. And I think Mopa will get between 10 and 14 goals a season, which, OK, are you ever going to find a 25-goal-a-year man? I don't think Brighton are.
Well, I'm not saying it's all Mopay's fault. No one else is chipping in, are they, for Brighton? So
no, but it's interesting broadly, and you know, I'm just looking at the top scorers in the Premier League. If you kind of even like the top 10, Jamie Vardy is the only one that you would say is a recognised, you know, striker in inverted commas. The rest are forwards, wing players, number 10s, etc. Even midfielders, Bruno Fernandes, Kevin De Bruyne. I mean, we mentioned Ivan Toney at Brentford. Is he a candidate for a move up the table to one of these teams to kind of elevate them? Is he a kind of...
I think he is. He's a massive creative force for Brentford, and he creates a massive number of chances.
And he works very hard as well off the ball.
But he does need to score more goals from open play.
Right.
If he played in a team where he wasn't the main creative element, I think he would get more of those chances himself. Mm. But because he's a very selfless player... I mean, to be fair, my Arsenal mates said they wouldn't mind, you know, if they bring, because they think they need to bring in 2 forwards. They wouldn't mind if Ivan Toney was one of those, they say, because he can do everything Lacazette does and more, in their opinion. Yeah. You know, Lacazette brings others into the play. Toney can do that, but they think he's actually more of a goal scoring...
Not me, by the way. Not me, Toney.
Get the boots back on, Tone. Come on.
They think Ivan Toney can do that and more. So it'd be really interesting to see if he does get a move at the end of the season.
Toney. In the expert here, the expert, the striker's view, not including Jamie Vardy, not including Harry Kane, not including those big 6 teams, who's the best forward, the best striker in the Premier League?
The one I like a lot is Ollie Watkins, because I think there's so much more to his game than just goals.
Yeah.
He'll stretch teams for fun, and he's had an indifferent time, but I do believe that he's shown a lot since he's gone to Villa. That will Ollie ever be a 20-plus goal a man? 20 goal a season. I loved it that he played alongside Ings, because let's get it right. It's really hard to be a forward in the modern game. I would hate to play on my own every week, which most teams do.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of teams don't want... And there's one thing Brighton are not very good at, is getting the crosses in when it's on. They will go in and out. They'll go from one side and come around and go out the other side. Yeah, yeah. They do that a hell of a lot, Brighton. You know, I've watched them a few times, Hugh, this year, and I've come and think, I'd hate to be centre forward for them. I wouldn't. All the things I like doing, wouldn't be useful in that team. So it's really tough in the modern game to be. You've literally got to tick every box: technical, speed, strength, hold up play. It's really, really tricky. And
you could have done it, Tony.
Well, I played, my final club was Nancy. I played with two strikers, two young lads that were both unbelievably quick. And it was fantastic for me because I just led the line and never had to worry about over the space behind. I didn't have to exploit space behind. They did. I would just lead the line. And it was great for me. If I didn't have that, wow, I'd be like, that's the end of my day. I'm done.
Listen, more stills to come on the Game Podcast. We will discuss the Manchester Derby at length. But remember, if you're enjoying it, rate us, leave us a review, and make sure you're subscribed. We'll also be getting Tony's predictions for the end of the season before the end of the game. Stay with us.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So let's come to events at the Etihad Stadium on Sunday afternoon. Manchester City 4, Manchester United 1. City sits 6 points clear at the top. Liverpool, though, have a game in hand. They are, City, a mere 22 points ahead of United. City having 24 shots in the game, 69% possession. They never really got out of third gear. The question for you guys is, was anyone actually surprised by this result and performance? I mean, come on, anyone?
No, not at all. Not at all. No. I said
it's not a story, is it?
No, barely, which is why we're going to be very quick and brief and why we didn't start the podcast with it, Hugh. Lots more teams, lots more interesting stuff to talk about. I think, you know, United are an average team with some star names who occasionally perform. They're battling for fourth, but they're not as fun to watch as Arsenal. They're probably about the same level as Tottenham. And we just have to factor that into the debate now. We can still be constructive and talk about where do they go from here, who the next manager should be.
And we will.
But we've got to factor that in. We can't just kind of sit there and go, oh my God, they've lost the Manchester Derby 4-1 to Manchester City. They looked okay for parts in the first half. And when they equalised, I thought that was a good goal. They had a bit of a spell of pressure. But it's not that surprising, no. I wasn't surprised at all.
Not really in the same stratosphere. Maybe the only surprise is that it was a derby and people expect a little bit more effort in particular. Certainly Roy Keane did in terms of a derby from the Manchester United players. Tony, the second half was a big contrast to the first half. United had 5 shots before the break, none after it. They had almost 40% possession in the first half, just 21% after half time. For you, what changed in that second period?
I'd love to know what went on in the dressing room at half-time. I really would. Because if you can show what you do in the first half, and it was a close call, wasn't it, in the first 45 minutes? It showed a lot of effort and desire to get into certain positions. You go in at half-time in the dressing room and you come out, and from the very first minute, it was a completely different performance. Everything that they did in the first half, they didn't even get close to in the second half. There's a lot of concerns at Man United. I don't get for the life of me, and look, they're not a one-man team by any stretch of the imagination, Manchester City. But Kevin De Bruyne, allowed to get on the ball and not be pressured or get close enough to him, is a disaster for you. You're asking for so much trouble. And it was a bit like I touched on the paper this morning with Odegaard at Arsenal. one thing they were guilty Watford are doing is not getting on him because he's sitting in pocket positions. And that's what De Bruyne does. He does it for fun. And then once he gets on the ball, everybody else will be brilliant because he's picking passes, he's finding his colleagues and causing mayhem. And I don't get... Look, United have got to get away from McTominay and Fred in midfield. Pogba's their best midfielder by a country mile, but he wants to leave the football club. And I think it's like an exit door moment at Man United. There's a few of them that see the future or the grass is greener elsewhere. And that's one of my criticisms of how that club has become. I played at Old Trafford three times. 4-0, 4-0, 5-1 was beaten. OK? They could match you physically.
That's because you had your big new contract and you didn't want to play.
No, Al, I promise you. It was because with all the brilliance they had as players... They rolled up their sleeves, they chased you, they hustled you, and they were physically intimidating. That's what Man United were. That is not what they were on Saturday. And one of my biggest problems with Man United team is Fernandes. If he was my teammate, I'd be telling him, stop waving your arms around at me, and every time you lose the ball or every time you misplace a pass, you're putting your arms up in the air, sending out a message. He would drive me crazy. Because he's part of the problem. And I don't mean he's the scapegoat. He's part of a problem with Manchester United at the moment. Because, you know, it was all about Ronaldo, the problem, not so long ago. And yet, Ronaldo's a 37-year-old man who's been incredible everywhere. And I find all this scenario developing at Manchester United really strange.
I might as well come to it, Alison, with you, because... It was one of my later questions, but since Tony has brought it up, Harry Maguire, Cristiano Ronaldo, Fred, Scott McTominay, Aaron Wan-Bissaka, we've spoken about Bruno Fernandes, we heard at the weekend a hip flexor injury for Ronaldo, Edinson Cavani apparently having trained, reportedly said he wasn't ready to play in the game. The squad is full of players who either don't want to be at Manchester United or shouldn't be at Manchester United. Before we come to what happens next, there are a number of players in there that you could say are scapegoats because they've been criticised massively individually. But when you put them all together and you list them all out, it's a shared responsibility for what's going on at Manchester United, isn't it?
Easy to point the finger at quite a lot of that team because they don't... Ralf Rangnick came in with this reputation for... having invented the pressing game and it being his thing. And we all knew there was no pre-season, so how's he going to transform a team that don't look anything like a pressing team? I mean, they physically don't look like it, as well as, you know, the stats show it as well. They're not built that way. They're built, to me, they're built as a counter-attacking team and they should be playing the opposite formation. They should be playing three at the back, using the wings, using the flanks, getting the ball in, counter-attacking, punishing teams that play a high line. They're built for that. So I don't know why they're playing this narrow 4-2-2-2. It's wrong. And it's because Rangnick is going to move upstairs and implement a philosophy of pressing football, which is why you get games with Man United where they play quite well in patches. And in this case, they played quite well for the first half. And the reason they came out after half time is because they're knackered and they're being told to work harder and they're not built for it. That's what it's about. They're not built for it. They're built for being in a machine. Each individual player thinks they're part of a wonderful machine where they play their role because they're technically gifted players. That's what they think they should be doing. When they're being told to press more, show more effort, run more, be something that they're not. And that means they come out and they look like they're not trying because they cannot do it. That's not why they're there. It's not what they do. They don't like it and they're knackered.
Are you sure? Because, I mean, we're seeing, you know, and we've seen it in previous games, not just this weekend, a player with a ball at their feet, Tony, going a 3 or 4 or 5 yards away from Bruno Fernandes, for example, and he's not even attempting to get close to them. He's just standing off, walking. No real pressure being put.
Because they don't like the tactics and they're tired.
Are they tired, though? That's my point. Is it not a mental thing?
Well, if you're physically tired, you're mentally tired.
No, but my point is it a mental thing that they don't want to play? I agree with you that maybe they don't want to play this system, but is it not in their lungs? You're telling me that they physically can't do it. Because mentally, I can agree with you on. I don't think they want to do it and they're choosing not to do it. I asked Ralph Rangnick previously, is your team unfit? He says, none of the analysis shows that our players are unfit. None of it. I don't, in any of our victories, they run a lot. You know, when we're playing well, they're all over it. They can cover the ground. So I don't know if they are actually that unfit at Manchester
United. If you cover the ground when it's clicking, the way that City cover the ground when it's clicking, it doesn't feel tiring.
So it's mental.
No, because you're expending more energy doing something that isn't coming naturally.
There was an incident, and they've highlighted it, didn't they, after the match on Sky, where they say seven City players chasing after a ball when they lost possession. Now, you certainly couldn't show that image of Man United players doing that. I think they've made huge mistakes in recruitment. I think most of the players they've bought in, and some of them for really big fees, have devalued from where they were. You know, you would never get 50 million for Fred. You wouldn't get 50 million for Wan-Bissaka, Harry Maguire, 80 million, and many others. I would also question Varane coming to the football club, although he's not responsible for yesterday. But I would say every time he's got a twisted sock, he's out of the team because he's injured every other week, you know, from one week to another. There's not one thing that you could say that's the reason why United are failing. I think it's a host of reasons. And it's very layered at Manchester United, where I think it's an incredible challenge for anybody. And I sort of agree with sort of both of you in a way that there is a part of not wanting to. They don't like getting tired. They certainly don't like it. You know, I've been in games myself. You're shattered. You ain't got nothing left in the tank. But what gets you to that position to close someone down? A desire, a hunger to push yourself. You've got to do that. That's a given in football. They don't want to dig deep. They don't want to go to the well. And again, going back to the past, and we can be guilty of always going back to the past, they went to the well every game. This team doesn't want to go to that well.
Maybe I was just, I guess, seeing the images of Ryan Fraser, hands on hips, absolutely shattered on Saturday, and then watching my beloved Manchester United players on Sunday was such a juxtaposition that I, of course, am scarred now. Tom, what do you think about the problems at Manchester United? Whether you want to talk about the game itself, whether you want to talk about what's overarching?
I think overarching is the more interesting and more pertinent thing to discuss, because as we said with the game itself, I don't think it was that big a deal or that great a shock. The guys have touched on lots of things. I think one way in which you can tie it all together is coming back to that word identity. And they've had lots of different managers who've had different either styles of play, and the recruitment hasn't chimed with that manager. You know, Jose Mourinho fell out because he wanted certain types of players, i.e. the older, more experienced players that had won loads of trophies already to come into different positions. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer didn't really have any kind of tactical identity, so they just went out and bought lots of star players, lots of mix of young players, star players, and, you know, hope for the best. Ralph Rangnick is now, as Alisson says, has a definite style of play, and it is fairly interesting that someone like Anthony Elanga, a young player, pacey out wide, someone that Rangnick has kind of brought through at various different clubs, is doing well. It's interesting that I think Jadon Sancho is finally seeing an upturn in form, one of the rare bright sparks of Rangnick's time, because they suit and probably are getting more out of his management style. He, and then this transitional phase, if he then picks his successor, will only work if you then recruit the players for that manager. You know, Tony talked about bad recruitment. I just don't think it lines up. And we do it too often because they're miles away. But if they want to be back at Manchester City and Liverpool levels, they pick managers with identities and tactical styles on and off the pitch, and they bought players for that identity. They're doing it at Arsenal now. That's what Mikel Arteta's done. It's taken a long time, but that's what they got now. He wanted players that could play that fast, zipping, passing play, and that's why you then get it this season. You go, look, they're brilliant to watch, but it's taken a long time, and so United might need to pick a manager and do that and give them the players, and it'll mean some big names leaving, definitely.
There is something I did want to ask you about, Tony. Chelsea in particular, not really their result, it was just the moment. I know you spoke about it this weekend. Chelsea boss Thomas Tuchel criticising some of the club's fans after they chanted the name of the club owner Roman Abramovich during that minute's applause in support of Ukraine before the game against Burnley at the weekend. Thomas Tuchel said afterwards, it wasn't the moment to do this. If we show solidarity, we show solidarity, and we should do it together. We do it for Ukraine. There is no second opinion about the situation there. They have our thoughts and our support. We should stand together as a club. It was not the moment for other messages. Just as an ex-Chelsea player, what was your reaction?
Well, I thought Thomas Tuchel handled it brilliantly because it was mistimed. I don't believe... Sometimes fans can be really stupid and do stupid things, and like we all do in life, we make big mistakes. I think it was basically... From Roman's time as an owner and the success the fans have had under Roman, it was all sporting. It was nothing to do with the bigger picture. I just think they forgot what the why they were. It was happening that, you know, we shouldn't be singing his name now, but they've done that. And it came out so badly, the timing of it, because I think it was all based on the success of what he did sporting wise and nothing to do with the politics.
Yeah, I don't think it was sign of support for what's happening from the Russian perspective. I agree with you on
it's
that.
It's just
very poorly timed.
Oh, the timing's terrible. But do supporters sometimes think about that? Do we, you know, the moment that, you know, you're getting the feeling of a sort of celebration for the Ukraine or put, you know,
a show of support.
Show of support for them, that they chose to sing a song. Did they really think, well, we'll do it at that time, and then think of the consequences? Sometimes we don't, you know, in normal human instinct isn't to do the right thing all of the time. I think they got it totally wrong. And I was on the radio at the weekend talking about it, and a lot of Chelsea fans, and some of them went to the game, had said, even after it happened, they sort of thought, oh, we've got that wrong.
Mm.
It felt wrong to be clapping for there to be a minute's applause for solidarity with Ukraine. There's a war on. Where do we start clapping when there's a war on? There's something is marked almost every the start of every match now, and you think, really? You know, it's diluted the impact it has. A minute silence has gone right out the window. So everyone's applauding whatever they want to applaud. No, not war. That is the moment to be grown up, have a minute silence. It would have so much more impact. And I actually stopped clapping because it just felt immoral. And I don't know. I think people think, oh, we'll have applause because people might make a noise in a minute silence. It's easier. Applause masks the idiots. No, let's go for it. If you want to show solidarity, make a statement, have a very serious, somber minute silence. I don't like the applause at all.
Okay, I appreciate both your answers on that. Listen, we've still got more to come on the Game podcast. We're going to be playing Ask Tony next, since we've got Mr. Cascarino with us. Stay with us on the Game. Right, to end today's episode of the Game podcast, Tony Cascarino joining us, as I say, every other fortnight. Let's play Ask Tony, because all of us that appear on the Game podcast have just about made our predictions. Tony, it is easier for you because you're doing it later in the season than any of us, so you can't really complain about who you think will be champions. This is the first one, and maybe the toughest one to call.
City.
Easy?
I won't say easy. I think it's been remarkable that Liverpool have hanged onto their coattails, but I just don't see City dropping the amount of points that's required. I mean, Liverpool still have to go to the Etihad and win, which is not impossible. They're very capable of doing that, Liverpool as a side. But I do also think City's running is slightly better. And I do think Liverpool would have to win nearly every game. And I don't think they'll do that.
Tony, can I ask, we've debated this, you and I particularly, on City. And yes, they were excellent against a poor Man United side. Do you think they are as good as they were last season in terms of that relentlessness? Because my argument has been that I wonder whether they might just have a couple more slips in them, because I've watched them and I didn't think they were as machine-like. As you know, you and I have discussed it before, writing for the paper, that they are just this relentless machine that just gets wins whether they're playing well or not. I haven't felt they're quite at that level. What have you seen it this season?
Well, it's pretty close, Tom. You know, it isn't. We're talking small margins. Yeah. And if you look at the remaining games, if City won every one of them, you'd probably say, well, they're every bit as good as last season. They're a team that can go and win 9 back-to-back 10. Yeah. They can do that. And that's my concern. And I feel it's incredible what Liverpool have done to stay with them and try and put pressure on them. But they don't really foul with pressure. They always seem to come back with something, which they did the season before. They had an indifferent period, and then they went on this amazing run. I think City are made like that. They have so many players that can come into that team if someone slips out of form. I'd love to see Liverpool do it because I'm biased, because I'm a Liverpool fan. I just think it's a big ask to expect City to drop, you know, lose two games or maybe two defeats and a couple of draws. I just don't think they'll do that.
They don't need to, Tony. It's in Liverpool's hands. They just beat them at the Etihad and it's all over.
Yeah, I still think Liverpool's running is slightly tougher.
So what you're really saying is you think Liverpool are going to lose a few games?
Yeah, I think they will drop points along the way. You know, Liverpool weren't...
Don't you, Alison?
No.
They're going to win every match between here and the end.
Nearly at the weekend, by the way. You know, West Ham had two incredible chances.
Three incredible chances?
Well, okay, three.
Come on.
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't say that
best right back in the world, Trent Alexander-Arnold, just allowing chances again. We should have done a Liverpool section now I think about it on this episode of the game.
So I think City will do it. They'll have enough. Well, say enough. They've got enough anyway. We all know that.
I still think they need a striker, though. I'm just saying. Top four, Tony.
Oh, that's quite easy now, I think. I think it'll be City, Liverpool, Chelsea, Arsenal.
Arsenal, definitely.
Yeah, look, three games in hand at this stage of the season over Man United is huge. West Ham are really out of the running now, and so are Wolves. In, you know, obviously tonight there's a game with Spurs playing against Everton. I can only see Arsenal getting over that line now, and I think they've got Chelsea and Tottenham to play as well, which could make a difference. But Arsenal have got quite a good buffer on the rest of the teams behind
them. Big week for Arsenal, so I think we'll see the shape of what's to come. Hosting Leicester, hosting Liverpool, and then away at Aston Villa. That's a big week for Arsenal. So we'll see. We might change our opinion by the next time you're with us, Tony. What about the bottom three?
Well, definitely Norwich. I thought that was the final throw of the dice at the weekend. And they've been pretty poor all season. Watford, unfortunately, if you said to me, what is Roy Hodgson as a manager? I've always felt he's the point-a-game manager. If you was at the start of the season and you had 38 games, Roy's going to get you 38 points and keep you safe, because that's what he'll average around that sort of margin. And I think he's gone into a club at Watford where a point is not enough a game to keep them up. So I believe that will take Watford down. There were some really good things against Arsenal at the weekend, but I do believe that he's not going to be able to manage to get the sort of wins that are required for him to stay up. Burnley's an interesting one. Burnley's, you know, the 4-0, they were really good in the first 45 minutes against Chelsea, and then they end up losing the game 4-0.
They always lose when Ben Mee isn't playing, though.
Yeah, I mean, Weghorst has taken a lot of plaudits, so a lot of people saying how well he's played. I don't think he'll get the numbers in goals. You know, I see if he... Look, he's got one already in the Premier League. He'll do well to get even close to five. I think he causes a lot of problems and havoc, but I don't think he'll be on numbers, man, with goals that Burnley certainly miss.
So who are your three?
I would go for them three, yeah.
Okay, Burnley as well.
Yeah.
Not Everton or Leeds?
No, I think Everton's game's in hand.
Okay.
I just think there's... And again, they were in a serious position and still close to it, because, you know, again, what happens tonight, I just think they've got enough good players to... You know, Gordon's come in. If they get Calvin Lewis fit, Richarlison, you know, they've got enough there to midfield-wise... Not sure defensively, but still enough to stay up.
Would be a huge story if Everton went down, wouldn't it? Absolutely massive. Just finally, before we end the game podcast, I wanted to take a moment to praise the offside technology on VAR. Yes, this week we slam this a lot, you know, when it gives us a very marginal offside call, you know, a centimetre or two, we're all ready to queue up to say how bad it is and how it goes against the game. Two massive goals given this weekend by that very marginal, right, maybe the Riyad Mahrez one wasn't massive because they were already 3-1 up and there was about a minute left, but it was a big game. And then the goal for Sadio Mane as well, onside. I think we have to praise it. You know, it's a good thing. This is what it's all about. This is what was brought in.
And yet you have 28 minutes in which you all sit around twiddling your thumbs before you can celebrate. It's not a good thing at all.
Right. Okay. So if they were disallowed, it would have been better, would it?
No, because who knows what a really good Lino would have done in the circumstances.
So you say it's the Lino's fault.
No, what we need is we don't need it to be reviewed. We need the technology. If you're going to go down the technological route, you have it linked to the person with the flag. So everybody knows in the stadium, if the flag goes up, there's no debate. You don't celebrate. And if the flag doesn't go up, you still have that moment where you think, oh, it's going to go to review. I don't know what to do. You know that it's onside. So they need to move the technology one step forward so that everyone knows straight away if it's a goal or not.
Okay. You can easily get to 10 seconds. Easy.
Yeah?
You know, easy get to 10 seconds to make a call on a goal.
Okay.
Like Alison said, I mean, if you've got the technology there, you know, we're at the moment we're close to a minute and a half. I can't see how that can't be done in 10 seconds.
I've got no idea. I mean, so we've ended up criticising it, even though we were taking a moment to
pray. You should have seen that coming, Hugh, man. Come on.
I thought everyone would be on my side. Anyway, listen, thank you so much for being with me for the past hour or so, and thank you all for listening. Remember, if you enjoy the podcast, make sure you're subscribed. Also, make sure you're subscribed to The Times and The Sunday Times for more of our award-winning journalism, where, of course, you can regularly hear from Mr. Cascarino himself. Check it out online. It's thetimes.co.uk/thegame. We will see you all on Thursday. Take care.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.